Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Vince Wilcox, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tying the best-selling, most effective fly patterns. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Vince a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted. This is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Vince Wilcox about tying the best-selling, most effective fly patterns. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak Rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of the fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at Dave Whitlock put it, the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Vince, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Vince's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Vince's book, Vince Wilcox Naturally Artificial Signature Flies, courtesy of Vince, and we want to thank Vince for offering that up tonight as our main prize. And a lot of the flies we're going to be talking about tonight and the tying methods and so forth are in that book. So it'll be a nice, handy addition to your library at the end of the show. But if you want to win it, here's how you do it. You have to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be something that Vince and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using that text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Vince's book. Our guest tonight is Vince Wilcox. Vince began his fishing career as a child watching his father, who was a guide and commercial fly tyer, going fishing every chance he had up until college when he put the rods down for a few years before moving out to Fort Collins, Colorado, where in 1985 he sold cars, went to CSU for wildlife biology and a fishery science minor, and helped run Angler's Roost, a local fly shop. In 2003, for health reasons, led him to follow his passion full-time. Driven by a desire to catch more fish and create more durable and effective flies, he signed a contract with Idlewild Flies and later joined Umpqua talented staff of tyers, where they featured dozens of his patterns for sale around the world. He has authored two books on fly tying, Vince Wilcox's Guide to Tying Nymphs and Dry Flies, and Vince Wilcox's Naturally Artificial Signature Flies, and has written articles for Fly Fisherman, American Angler, Southwest Fly Fishing, Northeast Fly Fishing, This Is Fly, and remains a featured writer for Fly Tire magazine since 2005. After over a dozen years in the Rockies, it's time for him to return home in 2007, opened a new shop called Wiley's Flies, and as an online store, and has grown to a full-service outfitter, motel, and fly shop in Adirondack Park in the town of Raybrook, New York. These days, he can mostly be found running the day-to-day operations, but gets out and guides for trout, bass, northern, and muskies in And all that spare time ties about 10,000 flies a year to keep the bins full in the best stocked fly shop in northern New York. Well, Vince, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hey, thanks, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you and doing another show on the East Coast, which is nice. And tell we'll get into that a little bit later. But I'll have you tell them about where you're at and what you're doing up there.
Okay,
the,
sure.
You wrote this book and called, and it's titled Vince Wilcox, Naturally Artificial Signature Flies. So tell us why you wrote the book and a bit about that title, too, and, you know, how you got into to doing this whole book.
Well, yeah, it's a mouthful, that title, Naturally Artificial Signature Flies. So originally the name of this book was going to be Synthetic Synergism, but they didn't like my title. So, you know, sometimes you have to compromise. So, but it, basically what that means, and, you know, I think he summed it up well, was just a combination of taking synthetics and, you know, naturals and just combining different materials regardless of what they are to try and create more durable and more effective flies. And it mostly stemmed from a lot of people asking. You know, they see the patterns, they see them in the shops. They want to learn how to tie the flies, and really at that time, not a whole lot going on with videos. You know, GoPro wasn't invented yet, so, you know, in order to do something like that, you know, people were asking to, you know, write the book, and I wanted to show people what I was doing and let them see more of the creative process, you know, why I was doing what I was doing, how I came up with these ideas, and kind of some of the little stories and the backlines behind some of these flies that, you know, different friends, different people, different influences had in creating it.
Yeah, so a lot of these flies you'd introduced to the fishing world, so to speak, through your guiding and your shops and so forth. But a lot of them made it into the commercial market. Now, did all the flies in your book make it into the commercial market? Or?
You know, actually, every single one of them in there became a what you would call a signature pattern, and that's why it's, you know, the part of the cover and the title, Signature Flies. I think, you know, at the time and still today, I mean, it was kind of more unique for, you know, you kind of a lot of tying books that came out were on the same basic patterns over and over again, and so you know, to have those different flies in there and be a signature tire for a company, which just means, you know, somebody else is producing it, they pay you a royalty, and they get to use your name and your patterns and sell them. And so, you know, not common, you know, in other words, you know, nobody wants to release their secrets necessarily out there in the market. So it wasn't necessarily commonplace to do that. So I, you know, I kind of wanted to lay that all out there. And every single one of them was available commercially through, you know, a signature company, except for my Bunny Booger, which was tied commercially by myself, but never got picked up. Streamers have become more popular again, it seems here. Not maybe that they ever lost popularity, but they've certainly kind of evolved and become more popular again in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, things kind of go in waves, right? You know, where the popularity
right.
of certain things are come and go. In fact, there's a question about something like that here in a minute. So what criteria did you use to, you know, decide to put a fly into the marketplace, and how did you do it? I know there's, you know, we've got a lot of fly tires out there that always want to know, you know, how do you get a fly into Umpqua? You know, what does it take?
Sure.
You kind of share
sure.
that experience?
We'll give it a shot. Yeah, I think I think that when you're looking at something, and when I'm looking to, I'm never necessarily looking at you know, creating a fly, thinking, you know, boy, I'd like to sell millions and get this out there. You know, it's really difficult to create something new in fly tying. I think, you know, there's very few unique opportunities out there. You know, people will change a material or color or do something like this, and now it's a new fly. And I think, you know, and even myself, I have some of that, which I've kind of, excuse the expression, I don't even know if I can say this, but bastardized some of my own patterns to change them into other things. And, you know, you're going to have that. And so, you know, for me anyway, what I try and do is figure out, you know, whether it's an attractor pattern, which I love, I certainly we'll talk more about that as we go here, and, you know, the attractor patterns, or if I'm designing maybe a fly for a specific hatch, you know, say a good example would be a hairy emerger that's I've had for about probably 6-7 years now, and but more in the last 3 years it's been available, you know, kind of commercially, and it took a while. You know, I wanted to fish it during these blueing olive hatches, but also the fly we tied as a Isonychia. You know, we tied it as a PMD or a sulfur. You know, so we have different versions of these that we use. And so, you know, I can't go out one day and decide that, wow, this is the greatest fly in the world. You know, especially sometimes some of the rivers we have to work with are stocked heavily. And so, you know, what you want to look at, you know, I can go out there, you know, in June and I'm going to catch fish on a wide variety of flies. So I like to try things on a bad day. I like to try things on a really hard day. I like to try things on a very technical river, just, you know, so that it's not just like a little cutthroat stream or a brookie stream, so that you get a better sense of all around how is this fly going to perform before I really want to put that out there. And I think as a signature tire, I probably frustrate the companies I've been involved with sometimes because they're looking to add new flies. You know, well, what do you have this year? You know, where's your 5 patterns? Where's your 10 patterns? You know, what are you working on? It's like, well, I'm still working on those 2 I was last year. You know, and so it's a process. You know, you know, in that process, I guess I would say it takes time. You know, it definitely takes some time. But you know, most of the time, I think, you know, if you're a tire and you know you've been fishing long enough, you kind of get a sense when you're working on something new, this is going to work, and then you just spend time tweaking it. You know, you say, well, you know, this shuck, this could move a little more, or, boy, I'd like that to float a little better, or I really can't see that too good. How can I do that? Or, well, you know, if I could get this down a little faster or whatever it might be. And so there's all those little tweaks.
Yeah, constant, never-ending improvement, right?
Yeah. You hope so.
You know, that was kind of a similar. We interviewed Charlie Craven, who's done really well in the commercial market as well. And, you know, he said something, you know, pretty similar to what you said. Is I never start out, you know, thinking about creating something that's going to be good in the marketplace, but I'm always trying to solve a problem, you know. And that's, you know, basically what you're saying, too, is, hey, I've got a situation, I'm trying to resolve it, you know, so I work on it until, well, I do. And then, well, other people might like it.
Right, you know, hey, bonus, yeah, it looks good.
Any tips you can give to the aspiring fly tire, you know, to enter the market, to get their first fly into Umpqua or some of these other places?
Yeah, well, you know, that's difficult. I think, you know, I went through a process, whether it's, you know, Charlie Craven, a lot of these tires, different people. I mean, you go through a process, and for me that process was tying for some shops and really getting flies out there in high volume and numbers, and so eventually that company will come to you. You don't necessarily have to go looking for them, but now you're somebody, maybe you don't work in a fly shop, maybe that's not your field, but you still, you know, you still want to do that. So they will take submissions, and you know, if they see something that, you know, is good enough or it's going to fill a certain void maybe for them, then, you know, you stand a better chance. So perhaps looking for a void in, you know, their arsenal. You know, we've got the web these days, so not everybody has a catalog, but, you know, say, well, geez, you know, they're really missing this in caddis, and I've got this great caddis fly that I've been working on. Right. Maybe that's the easiest point of entry. I think for myself, it was just an awful lot of hard work yeah. and no money. So, you know, I mean, yeah. there is that path. You can tie tens and thousands and hundreds of thousands of flies, and eventually somebody's going to take notice and do that. But, you know, that path's not for everyone.
Yeah. I think what you said earlier would probably be a good thing to relate to these companies is the story behind it, you know. Why you originally tied this, here's how you worked through these issues, here's the changes you made, you know, here's the results I got. And I think that, if I was sitting on the other end, that would be very interesting to me as a, you know, a, a, fly distributor to know that, you know, and it shows thought, not, hey, I just tied another pretty thing. Kind of. So,
absolutely. Yeah, they definitely want that, and don't send them two unless
don't
they ask
for them two,
it.
Huh?
No, yeah. send them two dozen. show them that you've tied this. Yeah, you know, so it's make sure they know it's something that you've worked on.
Yeah, good. Well, we've got some questions, kind of, you know, just random things here from our audience, and I kind of wanted to run through those. And after we get through those, then we'll talk about several of the flies in your book, and you can give us the story behind them and the problem you solved and so forth with those. So. First up is Kyle in Centennial, Colorado. He said, what is the real difference in quality of flies when comparing mass-produced patterns at sporting goods stores compared to fly shops compared to one's own home-tied patterns? Obviously, there's more attention to detail when tying our own flies, but what other qualities are gained in tying our own fly?
Yeah, so, you know, the quality today has, you know, commercially, overseas commercially, let's say, compared to what it once was or certain areas. I'd say, you know, the Kenyan crowd is actually improving their quality tremendously these days, but they are actually doing a really nice job of it. And I think when you look at big box store versus a fly shop, they're basically buying the flies from the same people. However, there are the less expensive commercial flies out there. If you're a fly tier out there or just a fisherman, maybe you've gotten those spam emails because I get them all the time trying to sell me flies really inexpensively, you know. So, I mean, there's a difference in the level of quality there. There's no doubt about it. And every company has a little bit of a difference in their quality, I would say for sure. But they've done really well with that. And I think when you're tying at home, I think the biggest thing is – you understand it more. So when I send a pattern overseas, you know, when that heads out and that's going to get tied commercially and be sold to all the fly shops, the fly tire at those tables is going to look at that fly. They're going to see exactly what it is. And from there, they're just going to repeat the process. So if you've made a mistake in sending that pattern over there, they will repeat that same mistake, you know, the next 10,000 times. There's no thought to, well, you know, that tail's a little short. You know, this should be a little bit longer. You know, this is made to be a buggy material. I think one of the flies in my book that's a good example and still fished well commercially, but I think it was hard for the commercial tires. I've got a pattern called the lint bug, and just as the name might suggest, I guess, you know, it's a hairy little bug. And when it got tied commercially, they always tightened the dubbing up so much that none of the guard hairs stuck out. You know, so in a completely looking, different looking bug to me, it's a little midge larva. Now, I'm going to notice that. You know, the general consumer may have no idea. They may have never seen the way, you know, I originally tied it. But that is the way they tied it, and they cleaned it up because it didn't look right. It looked like, you know, hey, this, you know, we should clean this up. And so people at home, you know, understanding, you know, should it look buggy, you know, and the behaviors and the movement of what materials you're using, where I think commercially anyway, they're just doing what they see and you know, what they've been trained to do. And then there's some really good people out there, Chris Connedy being one of them, that, you know, runs things and for Umpqua and does a tremendous job. And so, you know, that's his job to kind of walk around and look at things. And, you know, then they get kicked back to the company. And then somebody back in the office, you know, in Louisville is going to look at this stuff. And so it's like, you know, it's difficult.
Yeah. So basically what you said earlier was, you know, when you're doing it yourself, you can pay more attention to those details and making, understanding the fly and knowing how it should look or how it should work. Will benefit your final result.
Yeah, and I think that's it. But, you know, for me, you know, I kind of got my start in that doing around 15,000 flies a year. I backed off for a long time, and then the market's really changed. And so the prices of materials have gone up. The prices of flies have gone up wholesale to where I'm doing more of the commercial tying again, where I'm doing 10,000 or more flies to put more flies in my bins, and trying to encourage, you know, some of the guys that work for me to do the same thing. And just because, you know, I believe in that USA Tide, but I'm also a commercial tire with a contract, so I definitely understand both sides of that.
Yeah, yeah. Tony McBride in Kansas wrote in and said, Vince, do you have a favorite fly tying material that is unique to your flies that most other tires don't use?
You know, and that's a good question. I think most people that are familiar with my flies could tell you this right away. And if you're not, it's not that microtubing does not get used by other tires. I don't think anybody uses it quite as much as I do. I think, you know, Shane Stalcup came out with this. Wow. Sorry, he's gone, actually. Probably 25 years ago, something like that. And there were other materials out there, whether it be Swanen Days or things like that, but not quite like this. And so, you know, the difference between them, you know, and how to use that material, it's just, it's such a great nymph body. It's so durable. And, yeah, you know, as a dry fly body, it's much easier than quills. And you can change the shade infinitely by adjusting your thread color. So I think if you're looking at almost all the ones I do, you could find it on just about every pattern I've done. And,
yeah,
you know, the other one's probably ice dubbing, which I still can't get rid of. I swear, I've tried. I've tried to look for other dubbings that I like. I don't know what it is, but, you know, I just keep using it. I started with that, and Frank Smethers, who many of the listeners I'm sure are familiar with, at one time looked at a little box of my flies in Angler's Roost when he was visiting. You know, it was just like a little curious sparkle on all your flies. Like, there's nothing natural in here at all. You got this sparkle everywhere,
yeah,
you know. That's a material that I've just, I would say, I've really gravitated towards.
Yeah, I remember when I first came across the tubing, and it might have been 25 years ago. I don't know. It's a long time ago. But I remember it was, and I don't know who was doing it, or it was in the magazine or whatever, but it was using the tubing and then filling it with oil and making San Juan worms out of it. And that was the first time I ever used tubing. That's my memory of the first use. But anyway.
Cool product. It's definitely a cool product.
Yeah. Well, we got to take a quick break here, Vince, and then we'll come right back and dive right back into these questions. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
Sounds good.
The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing, Internet Radio, and we're talking with Vince Wilcox about tying the best-selling, most effective fly patterns. If you'd like to ask Vince a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your questions. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Vince, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, what's going on in your fly fishing world? Tell us about your shop up there and your services and so forth.
Sure, yeah. So we are located in Raybrook, New York, which is inside of the Adirondack Park. It's the largest park in the country. It's a state park, not a federal park. And so we're kind of up in the sticks, about 50 miles south of Canada and 50 miles west of Vermont, if you're thinking of location. And we do trout, we do bass, we do northern pike, we do muskie. We float, we wade, we take trips up the lakes. We've got a motel, we've got an ice cream stand. There's a lot going on there. And then we also have the online store. So that keeps us busy.
Yeah, yeah. And what's your season up there generally?
Well, you know, everything kind of ebbs and flows, and so really from the middle of May until, you know, about early July most times, the trout fishing is pretty consistent. It's pretty good. And then when we get into the summertime, we start doing a lot more of the bass and the northern pike through July and August on some of our local rivers. And then, you know, you get into the fall and the trout kind of come back into play more. And spring and fall, again, the muskie fishing is exceptional, actually. We've got some really quality water fairly close by that we enjoy. So, you know, my two favorite things, I get to go out and the brook trout ponds actually have some rather large brook trout in them. The streams, most of the ones we have, if we see 10 or 12 inches, that's a bigger fish. So, you know, I'm out catching 6 to 8 inch brookies one day, which I adore, and, you know, the next day I'm going after 4-foot muskie or northerns or something like that. So there's a lot of variety. There's usually always something, you know, if you're willing to expand your fishing palette, there's something that's fishing really well.
Yeah. The only thing you're missing up there is, like, you know, tarpon, bonefish, and permits, right? Got everything else, right?
Right, just about, yeah. We're getting into our landlocked salmon season here in about a week, so we've got a lot of cool things.
Are they kokanee, or?
There are some kokanee runs, but we have landlocked, so it's basically the landlocked version of the Atlantic salmon. So, you know, without having to spend a lot of money, we can go fairly close by, not too crowded rivers. On a good day, you might catch a few. On a bad day, you're out there having a good time. So that's how it goes.
Good. Okay, good. Well, thanks for sharing. Oh, and what's your website address?
Wileysflies.com.
That's W-I-L-E-Y-S.
F-L-I-E-S. Yep.
Wileysflies.com. Okay, good. All right. Okay, back to the questions. We got CJ in Coventry, Connecticut wrote in and says, Vince, every few years a new must-have product comes to the market and takes off. Examples include the beadhead nymph, flash, and UV resin. Do you have any ideas on what the next big fly tying innovation will be?
That's right up there with creating new flies. difficult, you know?
Yeah.
Difficult.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've actually been working on a particular project for 5 or 6 years right now, which actually is a completely different head design that we've come up with that we just have had a really hard time manufacturing. Maybe it'll be ours, but there's a lot of creative folks out there. I think, you know, it's hard to create something new. You know, I mean, you can look at Blaine Chocolate. I think he's a good example. You know, you take an articulated fly and then you say, well, put 5 or 8 on them, you know. I mean, here you go. So, you know, there's ways to do things that really haven't been done. You know, Greg Senyo, Rico Puglisi, you know, their dubbing brushes is something I've gotten more and more into in the last, you know, year and a half. I don't know what took me so long. I think, you know, and this is, I'm off topic, but it's a good topic. So, you know, if people are out there trying to figure out something they should try, I can tell you it will improve your fly tying. It will make your flies work better, and they look great, and it's very minimal effort on the grand scheme of things. You know, they do come with a little bit of a price tag, but when you consider the time it takes going into that, they're a bargain. And so I think there are some things out there, you know, outside of there's the same old bead head. You know, you can put eyes on it. You can call it something different. You can take something and call it a helmet instead of a cone. And, you know, there's marketing things that are out there. But the actual products, it's difficult. It's actually difficult to, you know, to me anyway, make my job easier and for me faster, which not always is the case for, you know, every fly tire. They might not be looking for speed. But I'm guessing it will be something cool. We'll have to wait and find out.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things that, I can't remember who it was that I was interviewing, said, you know, they just spend a lot of time in these offbeat stores, you know, craft stores, eat stores, you know, away from the fly fishing world, and that's where they many times discover new materials or something to try. Oh, what's this? You know, and it comes from a totally different market. and then works its way into the fly fishing market because it's, you know, it's something that people have had success with or whatever. But he said he always finds things at the craft stores and stuff that you never
Can I say Hobby Lobby on here?
Hobby Lobby.
I used to have, there was one in Loveland and one in Fort Collins when I was living in Colorado. And
yeah.
I would go to each one. Each one, even though they're the same, they're not. You know, you'd find, like, different things. I'd wait for the coupons. You know, I'd get the online things. Absolutely, yeah, great places to play around.
Yeah, I think it was Rick Takahashi who I interviewed who was telling me about that. And
that sounds about right.
Yeah, so anyway, yeah, fun. Okay, Dino in Michigan asks, do you take special consideration in the movement with materials? Is lifelike or exaggerated more important in certain situations? Can you predict responses, or is it trial and error the normal strategy?
Yeah, so I think that anytime I'm trying to come up with something and I'm trying to tie a fly, I have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen with the material and the movement in the material. If you're somebody that's trying something and playing with something, you don't necessarily have to go out and buy a $200 tank with moving water in it, which is very cool, by the way. But you can do that. You know, if you want to get fancy, you could try your bathtub, or you know, just a bucket of water or something. You know, there were times where when I was designing certain flies, in particular dry flies, you know, a cup of water could be invaluable, and my hand over the top and shaking it around to see what was going to happen or something. So you can kind of work with what you have in front of you to try and figure that thing out. And I think when I'm looking to exaggerate, you know, movements in certain situations, for me anyway, to make it move, to make it breathe and do different things, much more important in a streamer world than a little nymph. You can put little things on nymphs and you can do things on dries. I mean, I've got articulated dry flies and things like that. Probably when it's most important might be in the streamer world. And there are certain materials, you know, that I like to use anyway, which, you know, like, I think nothing still beats a good old bunny strip for motion. So,
right.
You know, I haven't gotten into some of the newer tails and things out there, but I love bunny strips or something like that, so it's going to move a lot, you know. And so,
yeah, steel fur,
you know, you
or
can,
something like that.
Yeah, you can trial and error it, but, you know, there's certain things that just work really well.
I guess that's just working with materials over and over again and knowing their capabilities. And,
Yeah.
James up in Alpine, Wyoming wrote in, and I know this is going to be a tough one for you probably, but he says, pick five oldies but goodies that have been around for a while and describe any recent enhancements that have improved the effectiveness of the original fly pattern.
Right? That's an interesting question indeed. I think when I... You know, when you're looking at five oldies but goodies and they're around and they're changing, everything's kind of based off of something at some point, you know. We've all seen it or gotten the idea somewhere. I go to great lengths to try and credit where these ideas come from if I actually know where they did. And I think, you know, there's so many good ones that are out there, and I think it's very subtle. You know, I think in the case of, like a pheasant tail, you know, really simple, Frank Sawyer, you know, very simple pattern. And this sounds like a small thing, but throwing a tungsten bead on there, getting the fly down to the bottom faster, you know, almost, you know, you can call it check nymphing, you can, you know, euro nymphing, whatever you want to do. And, you know, the principles are all the same in every style of nymphing for the most part. There's times where I'll suspend things and do different things. But at the end of the day, if you get that fly down to the bottom, you're going to catch more fish. And so, you know, that's a really simple adjustment on a really old pattern that really isn't something radical. It's just a small tweak. And you look at like an elk hair caddis, you know, predominantly, you know, a material used in the Rocky Mountain West, you know, it's elk hair, you know, Pennsylvania, you know, elk. So you have these flies, and then, you know, you take something, and I've had a few versions of different things, and then you got, Jaeger, like with his Never Sink version, and, you know, you'll take, you know, a piece of foam and run it through and flip it over the lip, so now it floats better, you know, so there's, I think there's minor changes that have happened. I don't think it's radical. You know, a traditional Adams, when you turn it and you put a high-vis post on it, it makes that fly, you know, sometimes more visible, and it sits flush in the water. It's different. It's a different profile to the fish than what it once was. So there's a lot of really subtle things that have happened. I can't think of anything that, some radical improvement of something.
Yeah. Well, of course, the bead head, I think, was kind of a radical change, right? I mean, that we went from no beads to beads everywhere, it seems like. And then
gotta have beads. Gotta have different colors.
Plastic to tungsten to, you know, I mean, it's just on and on. Is there anything else that you remember that took the world by storm, like the bead head?
You know, I don't. I really, that's what I'm saying. I mean, but, you know, when I'm looking at fly tying and I'm looking at flies, materials have changed over the course of time. But I'm so used to seeing the different materials and things that it really doesn't. Wait, in other words, dry flies are still tied with hackle, and oftentimes they're still using maybe a hackle fiber tail or moose fibers or things. Not a lot has changed in some of those ways, although we have changed the way we do those. There's been a lot more foam. There's been a lot more articulation in recent years in particular. I think that in some ways some of these flies have gotten a lot larger on some of these, but, you know, I think they look better and they fish better, some of the newer flies, but, you know, I can't really think of anything.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I guess the fact of the matter, too, is that we're constantly still trying to imitate the same bugs. I mean, the bugs aren't changing, you know.
Right, same stuff.
Yeah, yeah, so there's only so much you can do, yeah. Mark Haynes in Brookfield, Pennsylvania, wrote in and said, I noticed you use a lot of foam in many of your patterns. What led you to use it, and what advantages do you think it has over more traditional materials like elk, deer hair, that are in many popular similar patterns?
Yeah, so I think for a while there, in particular, you know, difficult to get hackle. It seemed like the fashion world had more importance on it than the fly tying world. So, you know, I think a lot of people started using it more, and that wasn't, you know, me. That was John Betts, probably one of the earlier guys that really used a bunch of it. And I think it works really well for wings. I like it. It floats really well. It can be very visible. And in particular, putting it in combination with some of those natural hairs, which is a lot of what, you know, my book was about. And that's one of the reasons that I use that foam, is because it's able to give more buoyancy to flies in a lot of instances than I could get out of just using the hair.
Yeah, okay. He also asked, any tips for tying with foam?
So, yeah, I mean, I think the misconception with foam is that you can lash it to a hook and somehow it's going to float. And what I've learned is that might be true if you take 6 millimeters at a time. But, you know, most of the time people are using maybe a 2 millimeter sheet foam, also Hobby Lobby, great place, to get that. And, you know, when you compress it onto the hook, in other words, when you're tying an abdomen down and you're tying it tight along the hook so that your thread is cinching all of that down, there's not a lot of flotation at all in that foam. And also, I guess one tip there would be if you go with a lighter layer of thread first so that you're not pulling so hard. Even if you have a heavier thread, you tend to cut through it. So if you do a light wrap through first and then come back through, you can put more pressure because now you're cinching on top of the thread wraps that you've made instead of cutting through the foam. So that's one little tip, and I think with using it as something that floats, I like to leave some exposed. So whether it's hanging off the back of the hook, the front of the hook, over the top of the hook, so in other words, maybe you're tying in the back by the, above the barb, and then you're pulling it forward to where your thread's already waiting up behind the eye so that, you know, the abdomen of the fly, you know, it's hanging over the hook with that foam, and that will sit – on the surface, and that will float much better than something that's been laterally compressed all the way down. And that's one of the techniques I use, and the other would probably be stacking of the foam is what I call it, which is doing exactly what I just said, and then I pull the foam back, you know, to form a head. And so in between there, you get a little air pocket. It creates another, so now you have 4 millimeters of foam up in the front. And then I'll put a little foam indicator on top of that, so I've got about 6 millimeters of foam up in the front, which is, it does help to support that quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, whenever you're compressing the air out of that foam, you lose the floating abilities.
Right.
Yeah. Good, good. Thanks. We're going to take a quick break again. When we come back, we're going to talk about the little green machine. So stick with us, and we'll be right back. Captain Vince Jaspers of Flatstein Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook or tarpon. Captain Vince is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish flora and fauna. Call Flatstein Charters today and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Vince Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Vince Wilcox about tying the best-selling, most effective fly patterns. If you'd like to ask Vince a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, we did have a couple of kind of random questions here that came in on the Internet, Vince, so maybe we'll just grab these real quick.
Okay.
Dennis wrote in, he says, how often do you use UV-activated resin for patterns, or do you use it?
So I believe I wrote the first article on that subject in 2006 or 7 with the help of Ross Purnell and Fly Fisherman. We put something together. Bob Popovich was in there with me using Tuffalye, just different resins instead of epoxy. And so when it first came out, I might have been one of the first ones using it commercially anyway, and putting it on the back of little nymphs is all I was doing with it. So I wasn't, I mean, today they're using it for so many things and so many patterns, and in particular yeah. saltwater and bait fish and all of these things. So that was not my idea. You know, I'm not the originator of that, but I first wrote about it and using it in fly tying at that time because it was something a little bit newer. And I don't do it as much as I used to anymore. I still will use it once in a while. I don't use it really on my muskie or my pike flies much, so I do like it. I have used it on quite a few patterns. I still use it on a few of my nymphs, but it's not something I use a great deal of. But there's a lot of different resins out there, and it's tough. There's, you know.
Yeah.
15 different ones, I think, these days. You know, there's yeah. 3 or 4 popular ones, and then there's a whole bunch of different ones. But great, yeah, great products, you know. Real easy to clean up, real easy to use, and it's definitely become extremely popular.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about the little green machine. So this is one of your signature flies, and I assume it solved a problem. So why don't you tell us a bit about it? And Stuart from Chicago wrote in asking specifically about this one. He says, when you set up designing a fly, let's say, for example, your little green machine, what would be 3 or 4 things you would consider before sitting at the device and starting to tie? So why don't you keep that in mind as you tell us a bit about the little green machine?
Yeah. So I have a propensity to want to catch a lot of fish when I go fishing, so
really?
I think that, yeah, that was the problem it solved. I'm one of those mud puddle guys, so the little green machine, which has actually gained in popularity over the years, and these days is selling as good or better than it ever has, so it's been a long road, but I think it's because, you know, one of my friends, you know, I quote in my book, actually, you know, you're talking about, I tried to write about it, and it was so hard to write about that fly because I use it so many times in different sizes and different situations that I really couldn't just pick, you know, do this. So, you know, I believe, you know, he summed it up basically saying, you know, use it often. It catches a lot of fish. You know, that surmises it basically. And this is, you know, so you use it. So I'll tie very small sizes for midges and little betis imitations. And then I tie some larger ones, larger being, let's say, you know, 12 to 16 for the ponds and lakes and the still water application for different calabatus and different types of mayflies. And then with those little midges and stuff, I'll go down to even a 26 at times. But primarily, I fish primarily like 20s, 18s, 20s. It's small enough. And, you know, we were on the Green River and we were fishing. And there was a time where I always carried my tying stuff. I'd have my vise, I'd have boxes of stuff, you know, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to tie things. I don't do that much anymore, really at all, because I carry probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 to 7,000 flies when I travel, and if I don't have it, I'm in real trouble. So, you know, I don't think I need to bring anything with me, but I did solve some problems that way, and one of them was, you know, hey, there's this little olive hatch going on, and there's these midges, and the fish are taking some midges, and the fish are taking some, you know, olives, and, you know, I'm catching fish, but, man, I think I should be catching more. And so it was this crossbreed of a betis and a midge that, you know, was really a crossbreed of ideas bouncing around in my head from, you know, a pheasant tail to a swan and day's midge, you know, and trying to combine some of these properties that I really liked. And I think what I learned through that process and over a little bit of time that it took to, you know, really fully develop that was that, here's a hint and a tip for everyone. You can take any betis imitation and shrink it down to a size 20 to a 24, and you have an excellent midge pattern. So, you know, some of it was right there. Some of the knowledge on that was just, you know, very
yeah.
similar. Now, I'm using the antron for gills instead of little legs sticking out of a betis. So different materials to represent different stages of an insect. But, you know, if you shrink down little betis patterns, they happen to work really well. But if I'm going to sit down and I'm, you know, what am I going to consider? What am I trying to imitate? You know, what am I trying to do with this? What materials do I feel like are going to represent that the best? In other words, do I need gills or do I need legs? Should the tail be sparse? Does it need to be long? You know, do I put it on a curved shank or a straight shank? You know, what's it look like in the water? And I think for me, at any point in time, and something I've really prided myself in, so if anybody out there is listening and my flies have unraveled on you, I apologize, because I have certainly worked extremely hard at durability. I will go, you know, I would like to catch a couple dozen fish on a fly. And if I lose it in a tree or I lose it in a rock, well, then fine. Or if I mash it all up with forceps and bust it apart, getting it out of a fish's mouth or something, well, then, you know, I can live with that. But, you know, I want them to be durable. So I take durability into account. I like to pick out things that aren't going to fall apart.
Yeah, it's interesting. I 2 weeks ago I was fishing up on the Gunnison River here in Colorado, and I had a point fly that was a midge and then a betis just above it, and I was catching fish on both of them. So it tells you right there, you know, they're feeding on both, or they're having trouble determining what's what, but they were both working, so I could see how a fly like this would really be, you know, valuable in those situations. You know, kind of describe the fly to folks here, what the materials are, what it looks like, since they can't see it, if you could do that for them. And maybe mention
sure, yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, to that note, I think, you know, the Missouri River, I'll mention anyway, the shops in Craig, the guys at Wolf Creek, had a great time with them last year. And you just, you know, they're selling so many, you know, and to meet the guides and talk to people, because they're fishing them every day, because they're catching fish every day. It's not a difficult pattern to tie. It's got a pheasant tail, fiber tail, and then I'm using a microtubing for the abdomen. I prefer myself, anyway, when I'm fishing, I would say 90% of the time use chartreuse for my abdomen, but the best-selling commercial one is pheasant tail. It's a pheasant tail tubing with a black thread. If I'm using the chartreuse, I'll use like a light dun thread underneath it. And then your gills on there are antron, but it's split fibers. You can't just put a whole piece of antron in there. So if it's a size 20, it's really only about a third of a strip of antron, you know, a third of the fibers. And then, you know, if you go to like a size 14, you can use the whole thing. You know, it can be a little bit more exaggerated on that. The thorax on that fly is olive brown ice dub. And then the wing case that I use for that is Firefly, and I just really found that I loved Pearl Firefly as a material for wing cases. It's just a little bit different property than anything else I could find. It's made by Wapsie and should be readily available out there. And there's also a full-dressed version of these flies, I call it. There's the undressed and the full-dressed, which has a wire rib and a full flashback that runs all the way down. Same flashback, I'm just matching the wire color to the abdomen. So, you know, you can do it that way. And typically I'll do that on a size like 16 or bigger. And then if I'm tying anything 18 or smaller, I leave all that stuff off. Not that you couldn't put it on there, it's just it's not necessary.
Yeah, yeah. And I noticed in your book you give patterns for olive, dun, pheasant tail, chartreuse, and trico. So it's quite a versatile little fly to adapt to different situations.
Yeah, it really is, and I think with our clients and myself, like I said, you know, both, you know, unfortunately, it's like a blankie, you know, if things aren't going right, you just put that on, and I mean, that's that fly,
right,
you know, it does, but it's you know, like I said, there were other things involved there, you know, you get Frank Sawyer's brain, you got Randall Kaufman's brain, and you got my brain into that one fly. So there was a little bit going on there, and it's very simplistic, you know. You didn't reinvent the wheel, but I mean, you know, like I said, sales have been great on those. We probably, between myself tying them, you know, and production wise, and having a company do that for you for years is a much bigger thing. But you know, there's flies out there that have sold more, but you know, we've probably sold 500,000 somewhere around there. So nothing to sneeze at.
No. Sounds hey, if you're selling them, they're catching fish. That's what's got to be happening. So
we're trying. We hope so, right?
Yeah. So how about another nymph? How about Supermans? Tell us about Supermans.
Yeah, definitely different, right? It's a strange little pattern.
I looked at that and
so.
I go, yeah, this is like surrealistic almost. You're looking at this thing.
You know, it was created as a joke. People kind of bought them, I think, as a novelty at one time, and then figured out I would get these emails from people in different parts of the country that I was throwing a free Superman in with orders that I had for probably 2 years. You know, I said, try this fly, because the way it looked, the way it was designed, you know, I don't think people really gave it the credit, especially with the name. And so, but once they would fish it, I would get these emails that, you know, geez, you know, I was having this tough day. I hadn't caught anything in 3-4 hours. I put this on, you know, I caught a half a dozen fish in an hour, you know. And so, you know, similar emails like that would come in, and, you know, it would just kind of make me laugh, because when I created the fly, people were coming into Angler's Roost and they wanted blue flies, actually. In particular, they wanted John Bars, you know, they wanted a blue copper John. And they kept coming in the shop asking for blue copper Johns. Well, would you tie some? And I said, I'm not doing it, you know. And I specifically told people, if I had to fish a blue fly to catch trout, I'd go home. I don't need to be out there. So, you know, it was a pointed message. And eventually I got so many people asking me, you know, that I said, all right, you know what, if people want to buy a blue fly, I'm going to tie something kind of cool. And really the only thing I could think of was Superman. And so when I thought of Superman, you know, it's just kind of a cool story. It was actually, I think in 2000, oh, it might have been 2009 or something like that, with Fly Tire. There was a cover of like these superhero flies, and I had kids that were 8 years old, and I had 80-year-old kids coming up to me telling me they read it and how cool the story was, because I, you know, got into details about the comics and how it all started. But, you know, I'm thinking Superman, so, you know, Body of Steel, you know, Man of Steel here. So you got to have a wire abdomen, you know. And I mean, really, there I was not thinking about fishing. I really was thinking about having fun. And so, you know, then I blue microtubing had come out, so I'm going to knot some little arms so it looks like he's got arms sitting out. And, you know, got little legs hanging off the back of this fly. And, well, he needs a red cape, so I'm going to put this fuchsia holographic tinsel on the back of there that I found worked well. And, you know, he needs black hair. I'll throw a little black ice dub on. You know, I tie a few of these things up, and you know, we went out and fished it, and we caught a bunch of fish, and I was actually really surprised. And so then I started paying attention to the makeup of the fly, started tying them in pheasant tail, started tying them in olive, started tying them in like a sulfur version, like a ginger version, and kind of adapting with that. It's an attractor fly. You know, really an attractor mayfly, but I would use it for caddis. I would use it for little stones, little sulfur patterns, you know, different, all different insects, you know, typical attractor that you can kind of just change colors and size. And I found it to work really well. And then even when I moved back to New York, I knew rainbows. I caught a lot of big rainbows on blue ones. So I came back, you know, there's some steelhead close by, tied some on heavier hooks. And it's just absolutely dynamite nymph for steelhead. So it's been a surprise. It's a cool fly. People love it. You know, and you catch a lot of fish, so you really can't complain. There's
no
nothing
figure,
to complain
huh?
about. Right.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it turned into a good steelhead fly. Online here, Dennis asked a question about do you have two or three recommendations for steelhead flies? I didn't know you were in that realm, but are there any others that you have that work well for steelhead? Vince, you there? Okay, we may have lost Vince. Hold tight, folks. I am going to dial him back. Yep, he dropped off. Hold tight here. We'll call him right back.
Hi, you've reached Vince, Andy, and Madison. We can't get to the phone. Please leave us a message, and we'll get back to you. Thank you.
He must still be talking. Hold on here. I hope we can hang up the phone here, and we can dial him back. Let's see here. Just hang tight. Hang tight. Okay, let's try him again. We were just talking about this before the show. I said,
well, Roger, I hope that's you.
Yeah.
You know?
The whole world knows what your answering message on your machine is.
Oh, my goodness. There you go. Well, I tried to pick it up. The whole world should also know that Magic Jack's not great. I can't make conference calls, and apparently they don't work that well. We talked about this. I said it was going to cut us off tonight.
Yeah. Everybody, before the show, I said, well, if for any reason, you know, you get dropped from the call, I'll just call you back. And I said, it's only happened like two times in the past 10 years. And he goes, oh, it'll probably happen to me tonight. And sure enough, it happened.
Oh, yeah, I can't even make a conference call. So if you ever want to make conference calls, don't use Magic Jack.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway,
the
question was, you just mentioned the Superman being a good fly for steelhead. And we had a question come in here from Dennis asking if you had any recommendations for steelhead flies. So are there any others besides Superman that you could recommend?
Yeah, you know, there's it's not in the book we're talking about, but I mean, absolutely, one of my favorites is called a simple stone that I tie, which has like a grizzly marabou tail, midge diamond braid body. I like the lavender pearl chenille for the thorax area, and then I use like a clear tan for a set of rubber legs up on it with a big tungsten bead. Those work really well. And then there's another one out there that's, you know, I'll talk about somebody else's eyes there, but Mark's big eyes. I think between those two, that is probably as consistent as anything, unless I am fishing a, you know, a midwinter run or a really early spring run, and sometimes we can get away with a lot of smaller, like, stonefly patterns and little caddis patterns and stuff, too. But those are the ones that, you know, 9 out of 10 times, that's what I'm going to have on.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of these flies, that whether it's in the book or you've talked about, I assume you can get on your website as well, right? All your flies, I assume, right?
Correct, yeah. We actually have hundreds and hundreds of flies. I think you might be surprised for a little shop what we actually have for an online inventory as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of great patterns. And, you know, as a shameless plug, I'll say that our prices are fantastic too. So you should take them.
Yeah, good, good. Okay, next up is we're moving into some dries here, and we did have a question on get organized here. Dean, who I have to give Dean Wormell in Massachusetts, who actually introduced me to Vince, so I want to thank him for that. And he wants me to tell us the history about the para variant. So there must be a story behind this one as well. So you want to kind of describe this fly and tell us the story?
Yeah, there definitely is a story there. Yeah, so Dean's son, Matt, works for me, and so we call him Worm because of Wormell. His sister is Sam Juanita. And Dean is actually Nightcrawler. So I want everybody that knows Dean when they see him next time to call him Nightcrawler. So I'm sure I'm going to hear about that. But, yeah,
that's a hell of a name for a fly fisher, you know.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's a term of endearment. So, yeah, the paravariant and the history behind it. Basically, the very simple part of that is it's a name of a particular fly and not a style. And it was patterned off of the H&L variant, so the house and lot. One of my favorite high country dry flies, you know, I thought that thing was great. And President Eisenhower, when he came to Colorado, that's what he fished. You know, this was his fly. It was big, it was bushy, it floated, you could see, you know, see it, the fish ate it. So, I mean, everything about the fly was great. And so when I was trying to figure out, boy, I'd like to do something a little different with this fly. So, nothing revolutionary. I'm going to throw a parachute on this thing and use some high-vis materials so that I can see it. And that's where microtubing really kind of grabbed me on a dry fly perspective. And because I kind of thought in my head, and it's still hypothesis, but I believe it's true. Now, how much it helps, I don't know. So when you take a tube, and it is a tube with a cylinder of air in the middle, and I would squeeze it tighter at the back of the fly. And then as you release pressure with your tubing, what you can do is you can taper a fly just like you would with dubbing. And so I would release pressure as I came forward. And what I believed was I've sealed off the back of this so that, you know, this is airtight on the back of this with this little tube. Much like you were talking about where somebody was throwing oil in there. I never really did that. You know, I didn't inject anything with the oil in there. But when you made a bigger tube of air up in the front of the fly to use it for the shape, I really think it helped the flotation. It doesn't absorb any water, for one, and you do have that little cylinder of air. And probably more importantly than that to me was that natural quill body flies, although pretty durable, would break, in particular with forceps. And they're a little tougher to use, whether I was going to soak them, not soak them, whatever was going to happen with them. I just found them tougher to use. They were smaller. They were shorter. I could get a 10-inch piece of tubing, and I could do anything I wanted with it. I could, you know, alter the shape and the width and the color of it by changing thread color. I mean, just a fabulous material. So we kind of touched on that earlier, but that's really started with this paravariant. And, you know, you keep that big bushy tail so you can float your droppers, because if you're not fishing droppers, and I love fishing, you know, dry flies, and I'll fish a lot of technical dry fly stuff, which is some of my favorite, but I love throwing in a tractor and, you know, just having a ball with something that floats really good and putting a dropper on it. And so, you know, when you're creating that, I wanted it to take on all those characteristics of that H&L. And so I did that. I think I made it more durable. It rides different in the water. I think it's a little more effective for pickier fish than what an H&L variant was. Sometimes, you know, you got a big bushy fly with big white wings. It can only carry you so far. When you kind of change the colors of a paravariant, you can cover a little bit more ground, different types of hatches. You know, whether I want to cover drakes or isonychias or whatever I'm going to do, I can change the color. And from an attractor standpoint, maybe I'm going to fish chartreuse or blue. So just a lot more variation from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But primarily an attractor pattern in general.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And it's amazing. Better than them having your hit your strike indicator, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, what about next up? I thought I had mixed another one in there, and I didn't put it. Okay, I didn't put it on our agenda here, but I think we have enough time to squeeze in three more here. The other one I want to talk about is AC caddis.
Okay.
So that's one that I thought had kind of an interesting, you know, problem to solve there, and how this does solve some problems, whether you started out that way or not. But tell us about this. Of course, another dry fly here.
Yeah, the AC caddis, you know, it kind of started a lot of things for me, really, that little pattern. You know, I wanted to be able to cover different stages of a hatch. So most of my flies, when they're dry flies, are set on emerger hooks. Some of them are straight shanked, but most of them are emerger hooks because I want the shuck hanging down in the water. I want the abdomen. I want that parachute-style flies. You know, I can get it to float flush and also have that shuck tailed into the water, but be able to see it, you know, and be able to put a dropper on it if I want to. So, you know, when you've got trout in particular, you know, we give them a lot of credit. You know, they've got a brain the size of less than a pea, and, you know, their instincts are tremendous. Their brain's not. And so what you need to worry about is, how do I trigger instincts? You know, how do I get these fish to strike? And so with some of those strike triggers, you know, if you can make something look like it's stuck in the surface film and it can't get away from them, then they come after it a little bit a little bit more often. You know, when something is constantly, you know, cruising out and jumping right out of the water on them, they're a little more hesitant. And so if they think something is stuck, that's probably why, you know, a lot of different cripples and emergers work so well. Those fish will decide to go ahead and bite that, you know. And so it works really well for a caddis. It worked great as a baitus for me. And, you know, I think when people see the caddis coming on the water and there's an emergence, you know, it's an exciting time. I think, you know, it's fun. You don't have to have as good a presentation. You can skitter the fly. You can jerk the fly around. And so a little bit different. And I created this one to match the hatch a little bit more, to where, you know, I've got antenna pulled forward out of the elk hair so that, you know, we've got an elk hair wing, and the parachute is actually made out of elk hair, and then we put the standard hackle on there, and then I pull a couple of fibers forward. So when you're in a situation where you needed something that was, you know, better match the hatch type of fly, it worked extremely well for that. It could support a little dropper. It had a lot of buoyancy. And if I didn't need the antenna, I would pop them off. If I was fishing like riffles and pocket water, I didn't really need the antenna. So it was great, you know, worked really well.
Well, in your description of the book, too, you also talked about the female depositing eggs. How did this play a role with that?
Yeah, well, you know, when they're ovipositing, I think, you know, when you find that happening and they're doing that, and you can have a dropper that mixes with it, too. So if you've got a dropper beneath it, my TNT is a good example of a pattern that you can put underneath that and kind of swing that up. I think when you're just dead drifting, sometimes you're not getting the best out of that fly necessarily when it comes to caddis. And so taking, you know, a pupa, and they're really a lot lot of people think, oh, it's a caddis emergens. It's actually the egg-laying stage. So a little bit different. It looks very similar, but and it'll work the same. So the good news is we don't have to figure that out entirely. But if you've got that dropper down there and you can swing it and skitter it and skate it, and I think skitter skate, pop skitter skate, one of those terms I like to use with people, pop it, skitter it, skate it. The trickiest thing, I think, with that is, you know, I don't want somebody to move it necessarily a foot all at a time, although that can work for you. It's just a couple inches, and then a dead drift back, and then you're pulling it forward a little bit. And with caddis, you know, especially if you've got a dropper and it's coming around on a swing and it's at the end of your drift, you know, just skittering that back up and letting it hang there for a second can bring out some of the best strikes of the day, in particular when the females are coming out to ovipositate and dive down and get their eggs in.
Yeah, yeah. What's the AC stand for?
The anything caddis. So, being able to represent multiple species, multiple stages and species.
Tell us about some of the materials you used on this, because some of these things are a bit different than we normally would see on a caddis, I think.
Yeah, so the shuck on that, the trailing shuck, so that it represents a little egg sac hanging off the back, is made from midge diamond braid. And when you take midge diamond braid, you can take a little pair of, like, English hackle pliers, clip it to the back, burn it, singe it to that. It makes an actually nice little egg sac off the back of things. It makes for a nice little shuck. And then, again, the microtube, microtubing on the body. And then we've got the elk hair wing, the elk hair parachute. Our antenna are pulled forward from that same elk hair. After we clip it, we leave two of them pulled out forward. And then you've got ice dub for the thorax there, another little bit of curious sparkle.
Yeah, good. Okay, time for a couple more. Let's move to terrestrials. The one that caught my eye was the glow ant. And, it's kind of like every other show, somebody, one of my guests mentions an ant as a, you know, one of those, you know, you've got to have an ant in your box because they work everywhere, you know, and I figure, hey, that's got to be a good one. So tell us about the glow ant.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of fun. Glow ant's one of those flies that I designed really to be like a flying ant, you know, kind of represent some of the flying ants. And you don't always have flying ants, but they tend to always work. So it's one of those things. If you're lucky enough, and I have been a couple of times late in the year already, to be out there and you've got a bunch of flying ants on the water, the fish will go crazy for them. So they will still recognize an ant at any time. In fact, I think a lot of people, at least that we talk to in our shop and try and send them out little beetles and little ants. If anything else, you know, it's one of those patterns that you should try. You know, if you're having a tough day, fish will usually respond to a little ant or a beetle. So the wing, as it might suggest, the glow ant is made from a phosphate impregnated yarn, a glow yarn that Uni makes. Actually, Montana Fly has a version of this now too, I believe. But you don't have to charge it or do anything. It automatically charges with sunlight. You can use a little UV light, and it kind of spun off of, I was making glow-in-the-dark indicators. I was fishing some ponds at night with a bunch of this glow yarn on the back I'd have on a fly, and I at first didn't catch on. All of a sudden, it would disappear because I had a dropper on, too, and fish would take the dropper. I wouldn't really see or hear anything but the glow disappear. So very subtle. You know, if you're fishing at night, it can make a huge difference to have something that glows pretty bright green, really, when it's charged up, in particular with one of those UV lights. So if you have a, you know, using those resins we talked about earlier, if you've got one of those lights, that'll really charge it up. And we'll fish them from like a size 12 to a size 18. They float like a cork, and they work most of the year, really.
Yeah, interesting. I think it's the only fly I've known that'll glow in the dark, but that's an interesting application.
It might be the only commercial one, you know, now that you say that. I don't know that anything has really been tied with glow-in-the-dark commercially.
Yeah. So kind of describe the fly to us as well here so people can get a visual of what this looks like and the materials.
Sure. Yeah, so you've got a 2-millimeter black foam, which is going to create the body on there, and you've got Midge Diamond Breed for the abdomen, and you've got black hackle around the center of that. And so you're tying in the foam off the back of the fly, kind of pulling that forward towards the eye, wrapping your Midge Diamond Braid forward, and then you're taking that hackle and your thread and making wraps in the center of that, actually more towards the front of that fly. And then when you pull the foam back over, as we talked about earlier, you're kind of tying that off right behind the eye and then pulling that back. You'll create like that stacking. So you get that double stack up there where you've got 4 millimeters of foam. The wing on that is the glow yarn, which is the phosphate impregnated stuff. And then you've got another little bit of foam up there with the psychedelic indicator stuff that goes on. Psychedelic foamicator, which has actually become extremely difficult to find. So if some listeners out there... has a line on the striped stuff that I sold for years. I'm running low. I had a stash that I thought would last forever, but I can't find it.
What would you put there instead?
If you don't have that, you could use orange. Yeah, something orange, something yellow, just another little piece of 2-millimeter foam, something you can see. Yeah, it's made for visibility, and you can actually, because of that stack in the front on that fly, you can actually kind of, you know, slide that, kind of pop it into the water, and it'll float back up to the top, actually, so it's nice. If it goes down a little bit, it comes rising right back up.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, we got time for one more. Another terrestrial, your VW Hopper. And I got to know where the VW comes from.
Yeah, kind of like my VW Beetle, which is called Herbie, if you can follow that. But
VW, Vince Wilcox. Vince Wilcox, okay.
Yeah, yep.
I'm thinking it kind of looked like a 60s VW van is what I was thinking when I was looking at the fly.
Right, it's kind of a cool fly. It's definitely a fun one. Yeah, well, that's that psychedelic indicator again that I'm running low on. So somebody out there has got a handle on it. I had to get it from England last time. It's one of those flies that, you know, some of the things I did on that fly at the time were things that people really weren't doing. Now it's very commonplace, and, you know, the poor thing's getting dated these days. It's becoming a, you know, a classic. But, you know, the Hopper was one of those things where I learned with foam that we talked about earlier, when you just, like, compressed the heck out of it and stuck it on a hook, that did nothing. So, you know, how do I make this work? How do I make this float? So I've got the bottom and the top color of the Hopper uses two different colors of 2-millimeter foam. The bottom does get compressed on the abdomen, but the end in the back hangs off the bend of the hook so that it's exposed off the back of the hook. And then I took eventually and said, okay, I need more flotation to get these droppers supported. So I think one of the key things with that fly, and, you know, maybe you could try it on your own, you know, Hoppers, I added another, you know, set of turns at the back with the hackle to put more hackle on the back of the fly, and used hackle around the abdomen to kind of support the whole abdomen. But more importantly, I put a lot more buoyancy towards the back of the fly that hangs the weight. And I really wanted to make sure I did that. And then when you carry forward, left that foam off the front, and then also stacked the foam again. In other words, you know, had the foam going forward over the eye, pull that back, tie that in. Now I've got a bubble that looks like an eye that I put adhesive eyes on, and then you're tying that on to form a head. So you get a bubble of air, you get an extra 2 millimeters of foam there, and a big elk hair wing. And, you know, just getting some crystal flash under the wing just to make it look a little bit more alive. I think, you know, Jack Dennis, Amy's aunt, I believe it was his daughter, actually, that, you know, it might have been the first time I saw that on a terrestrial, you know. And so it's just incorporating what makes it look like it's got more life, it's got more movement.
Yeah, when you wrap that the second layer of foam back around in the front, you're wrapping it around what you put the eye on, it seems. Is that correct?
So the eye goes on, kind of, yeah, it's, which way are we looking at it? When you fold that foam back over, it forms like a, what would look like a head, I would say.
Right.
When you tie it back down. And then I'm sticking those eyes in that, on those air gaps on the outside. So, you know, and I just found, and, you know, people can say what they want, think what they want. I'm a firm believer on the hopper patterns of adding an eye to it. So I think that does increase the effectiveness of the pattern. Could be in my head, but, you know, we tested it with and without eyes years ago. And when I put the eyes on, I caught more fish. You know, was I fishing on a better day? Was I fishing a better run? You know, at different times, I don't know. But after testing it out a lot of times, I just, and it looks great. You know, so the eye looks great on there. But, you can be your own judge on that. But it's great. So much easier to add eyes these days. And, you know, speaking of that, I mean, goodness, there's, you know, there used to be one or two eyes you could get. Now there's, you know, 15, 20 different versions of that, too. So you can kind of have some fun with that.
Well, that brings up another, my last question for you is, you know, thinking about these hoppers, you see these Chernobyl hoppers, and, you know, there's all kinds of things, all kinds of crazy-looking things. What are the key elements that you look for in that kind of a tractor, you know, beyond eyes that you think have to be there to have a successful fly in that arena?
Yeah, I think with the terrestrials in particular, when you're talking about hoppers, you know, they have certain features, and so, you know, they have a big set of rear wings. You need something to represent that, you know. In the particular case of that VW hopper, you know, it was elk hair. You could use other products out there. There's synthetics that you could use. You could use a foam wing off the back of there, but that's something that the fish are going to see. You know, that is something that I think is a triggering device. And then I think we all see, you know, ever since you're kids and you try and catch them and hang on to these things, you know, they got these great big rear legs, you know, that are very visible. So you need something. And in, you know, in the case of what I did, you know, I'm using rubber legs. And I like the rubber legs for a couple of reasons. It represents that twitching on the water, but it also stabilizes the fly. There's some really cool-looking hopper patterns out there that don't float well at all, and they kind of ride on their side. It doesn't mean they're not going to catch fish. They just don't balance very well. They don't sit upright like they're supposed to because they have some legs on there that look great. I'll say it's one of those products that I kind of phased out of my hopper tying after a time, and crickets that I tied with. There was TNT legs. They're still produced. It's like a little rubber leg. They look really cool on there. They don't float well. They weigh the fly down, and they spin the heck out of your leader. So, you know, I mean, there's some of these things you don't have to really overcomplicate on there. And then, of course, the eyes. We kind of talked about the eyes.
Yeah.
In light there, and I, you know, to me, they're just important triggers on that.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, we got to wrap it up here. We've run out of time, and I am going to give away here in just a few minutes our prizes: 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1 year subscription to Fly Fishing and Dying Journal. And also a copy of your book, Vince Wilcox, Naturally Artificial Signature Flies. So stick with us, folks. We're going to do this few giveaways, and we'll be right back. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal land may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org. That's SaveBristolBay.org. And there you can learn more about how you can get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link under our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure to do so for our next show. You don't want to miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes we have. If you are the lucky winner of the drawing, we'll contact you after the show and get the information we need so that we can send you your gift. Now, the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So to learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org. Great, great organization to support and be part of. So let me fire up my, my little database here, and we'll pick us a winner. And just give me 1 second. And here we go. Okay. So, come on. So our winner for that is going to be Bob Kryn in Michigan. Bob Kryn in Michigan. So congratulations, Bob, on that membership in the Federation. I know you'll enjoy it, and it'll be something that you can brag about to others that you're part of. It's a good thing to be part of. And now we'll give away that one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And our winner for that is David Brady in California. David Brady in California. So congratulations, David. And I know you'll enjoy that publication from AmatoBooks.com. And if you want to see more of the publications they have and the books they have, go to AmatoBooks.com. Great resource for fly fishing information. And now we'll do we'll give away a prize. We're going to do our question answer here. And let me just make sure my cue's clear. And the question's going to be a simple one. We talked about a fly earlier called the AC Caddis. What's AC stand for? That's your question. So let's see. And Dean, I don't think you're qualified to win, so don't even bother. Dean's listening. Oh, yeah, so here he is. Well, here I get this message. Nightcrawler, San Juanita, really? I already have the book. Give it to the next person. See, I knew he would be in there. Yeah. Dean's actually won a lot of things. So, he says he already has the book. Hey, I think we got a winner here. Vince, I've got an answer that says anything caddis. Would that be it?
That is correct.
That's the correct answer. That's Joyce Deming in Golden, Colorado. So congratulations, Joyce. You just won Vince's book, and I know you'll enjoy it and make good use of it. So congratulations. Now, Joyce, you're a new name to me here, so good to have you on board. Please send me your mailing. I've got your email address and your name. I just need your mailing address, and you can send it the same way you just answered the question. And then we'll get Vince will send you out a copy directly from his shop. So congrats on that, and thanks, everybody, for playing our games and drawings, and it's always fun to do. Hey, Vince, thanks so much. I really appreciate you doing the show with me tonight, and it's fun to look at your flies and talk about them, and I encourage everybody to go out and get the book, get it from Vince directly or Amazon, a lot of places you can get it. So. But good book to learn some fly tying principles as well. But thanks for being on with us tonight.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, great. Good to have you. Our next broadcast will be on October 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to interview Jeff Currier. And our topic for the show will be fly fishing Sudan. Jeff, world-traveling fly fisher, went to Sudan to fly fish. Where did he go? What did he fish for? What was his adventure like? Well, you're going to have to listen in and find out as we go on another Courier adventure. So if you've listened to Jeff before, you're going to want to be on this because there's always a story. So we'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Watermaster, Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.